A special board meeting, and that's Cal, committee of the whole meeting. If I can ask Sarah to please take the roll call.
Trustee Bachner?
Here.
Trustee Karji?
Here.
Trustee Vasquez?
Here.
Trustee Brennan?
Here.
Trustee Hennig?
Here.
Trustee O'Connell?
Here.
President Odusi?
Here. Okay, so we are here. Greg Smith, our village attorney, is, will be talking to us about some of our zoning items and teaching us a little bit about municipal zoning.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. So this evening, I have both a PowerPoint and a handout for you. For those of you who've been through the zoning training before, it's pretty much the same as last time, a couple updates in here. For those of you who haven't been through it, what I've done is provided you with a 29-page handout. I'm not going to be reading the handout this evening, thankfully, otherwise you'd all be asleep before your dear conversation starts. I'm going to highlight the most important parts of it. And my goal in putting the handout together for you is to leave you with something that you can refer to help you when you have questions about zoning. So when issues arise, feel free to use this as a resource. It is tailored to the River Forest zoning ordinance. And then you can approach staff and ultimately myself with questions, of course, as zoning matters move on. So what I'd like to do is we could just start off on page one. You can see here I've broken the talk down into five parts. We're going to talk about the source of your municipal zoning authority. For those of you who are interested in knowing where your legal authority emanates from, talk a little bit about that. We'll spend the most time on administration of the village's zoning ordinance. This is the nuts and bolts of how zoning gets done in River Forest. What are the different types of zoning? What are the processes to be followed? And actually, it's a nice tie-in with Trustee Hennig's report during your regular meeting later this evening about notices. So we'll be talking about notices, and Trustee Hennig will give her update with her recommendations for improving what's otherwise required by state law. Then we'll talk about the important issue of voting. I've included a table, this is new for this presentation, with the various vote totals that this board must pass in order to approve zoning, depending on what happened at the zoning body below, okay? And then if there's time, we'll talk about conflicts of interest in Open Meetings Act. I don't intend to spend much time on those issues because they're of general applicability, not specific to zoning. So first on page one here, of the handout, you can take a look at where does the village's zoning authority come from. And it's really granted by the state of Illinois. As a non-home rule unit of government, the village only has the authority given to it by the state of Illinois when it comes to zoning power. Home rule units like the city of Chicago derive it from the Constitution. Okay, so they don't even need state law to do zoning. You do. Consequently, and I don't spend a lot of time on this in the presentation tonight, the state of Illinois has punched out areas where you can't do much with zoning, like with wind energy conservation systems, right? Windmills. Campaign signs in people's front yards, right? There's very limited things you can do with regard to their size. Because you're a non-home rule unit, we have to look to state law to identify your authority. There's also a very important United States Supreme Court decision from 1926 that said that your inherent authority as a government to exercise police power includes the power to zone, okay? So the United States Supreme Court has recognized local zoning authority. And finally, you implement it in Title 10 of the River Forest Village Code, where we'll be spending a lot of time tonight talking about how do you implement your authority that's allowed under state law. So on the balance of page one, under analyzing the validity of zoning ordinances and the LaSalle factors, this part of the handout going on to page two really helps you frame up how do courts look at your zoning decisions. Okay, there's been threats of litigation over the years. You know, I'm going to sue if the village doesn't do what I want, either as an applicant or an objector. You haven't been brought into court over a pure zoning matter in quite some time. But if you ever are, you should keep in mind that the courts, as a co-equal branch of government, presume that your zoning ordinances are valid. Okay, so someone who wants to challenge what you've done with zoning has to overcome the presumption of validity. That means that when this body votes to do something with zoning, you get a running head start in court. Okay, in order for someone to overturn a zoning decision, they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that you were wrong, which is a higher standard than the balancing act, than the 50% plus a little bit preponderance of the evidence you may be familiar with. So I just wanted to highlight that because as legislators here making legislative determinations, you do get deference if you end up in court. Okay, so your decision is very important. When you look at the bottom of page one and onto page two, there's a total of 9 factors that I've set forth. These are the factors that the courts rely on when analyzing zoning decisions. So if you're ever wondering, how are our decisions reviewed and determined to be legal or not in the courts, where the rubber really meets the road for zoning ultimately, it's these 9 factors, okay? So the first 6 come from a case involving LaSalle National Bank. We call them the LaSalle factors. Most of these are built right into your standards. So when your zoning bodies are making recommendations to you, they consider these things. We'll talk about that in a little bit. You'll see that there's several factors that relate to the uses of nearby property and the extent to which property values are diminished and really the effects on the public. The courts are very concerned with how your zoning decisions affect people in the vicinity of zoning being approved or not. Then if you turn to page 2, you can see there was a subsequent case involving the Sinclair Pipeline Company a couple years after the LaSalle case, which really adds in 3 new factors that deal with the comprehensive plan. Okay, you just went through this very long process, important process of updating your comprehensive plan. You may be wondering, well, how does that plug into what we do with zoning? The answer is that when the rubber meets the road, if someone challenges one of your zoning decisions, the courts are required to consider whether or not your decision in a particular case lines up with your comprehensive plan, which is supposed to be the overarching business plan, right? Not the implementation, as John Housiel said repeatedly, but the general goals and objectives. So the courts in Illinois say that your comprehensive plan matters when we measure a certain decision against it, okay? Any questions about that? So moving on to page 3 here, we're taking a look at the administration of the village's zoning ordinance. And what I mean by administration is, how do we do the mechanics of making decisions when it comes to zoning? What are the processes? Who's doing what at what time? Okay. Now the first is the comprehensive plan. This process just wrapped up in River Forest. And here you'll see in the handout some basics about the state law that authorizes comprehensive plans to be put into place, the things that they can address, future land uses, utilities, school sites, expansion areas. Your comprehensive plan does all this and a heck of a lot more, right? That's what John Housiel really did for you and delivered it. And again, the comprehensive plan is important because when you're making decisions, particularly on larger developments in town, the question is, what does our comprehensive plan say about it? Are we in alignment? Okay, and the process for doing comprehensive plan updates is that it goes to your plan commission, 7 appointed members who make a recommendation after holding a public hearing pursuant to notice, and then they deliver the recommendation to you, and you all take final action on it. Okay, so that's the process that was followed in this case. Next, you do have a variety of express authority under the Illinois Municipal Code to do zoning. So as a non-home rule unit, we need to tie back your ideas on zoning, and we want to regulate these kinds of uses in these ways, or these structures in these ways. On page 3, going on to page 4, is a list of some of the specific authority that state law gives you to do zoning. For instance, you can regulate and limit the height and bulk of buildings. This is why you can set maximum heights. You can set maximum floor area ratios. You can set volume limitations, lot coverage limitations, things like that, because state law allows you to do so. In the next bullet point, we have setback lines. In the next bullet point, intensity of the use of lot areas. And then the fourth bullet point, the last one I'll go over here, it allows you to classify, regulate, and restrict the locations of trades and industries and the locations of buildings designated for specific uses. This is what allows you to draw zoning districts and say that in the R1 and R2 zoning districts, we don't want heavy commercial uses. We don't want any hog farms in the Village of River Forest. We don't want things that are going to disturb the peace. Your authority to do this comes out of state law, okay? So unless there's any questions about those, I can jump into special uses next.
Just a question about the comprehensive plan. So say for the sake of argument, we were to decide on Harlem to put up buildings above what was in that box. We have to amend first the comprehensive plan to accommodate that and then change the zoning?
No, because the amount of language that was added to that box made clear that it was a guideline for potential future consideration. The final language gives the flexibility to go above, at, or below that number. It's meant to be it's meant to be instructive, not prescriptive.
So where would can you give an example of an instance where the comprehensive plan and the zoning are so incompatible,
right,
that
Sure.
It wouldn't work.
Absolutely. I can give an example. It would be, let's say there's a community that has within its incorporated footprint areas of greenfields being farmed, right? And they're in the comprehensive plan called out as being open space agriculture. But then a subdivider wants to come in and put in a residential subdivision in the area that's noted as being open space agricultural. If the municipality were to go forward and allow the residential subdivision to be developed there, and change the zoning without amending the comprehensive plan, someone could mount a challenge and say, that's completely inconsistent with the comprehensive plan. Comprehensive plan calls for low density, no extra streets, no extra lights, or utilities, and you've approved something that's the opposite of that.
But you could amend the plan to meet the changed circumstances.
Yes, and that's often done, in fact. When a development comes through that is appropriate, if it's at odds with the comprehensive plan, it's common to refer to the plan commission at the same time to say, do you think it makes sense to change our plan in this way? It's meant to be a document that changes over time. Does that answer your question? Good. Okay. So when it comes to special uses in the village, there's a variety of considerations. We're on pages 4 and 5 of the handout here. A special use is a use which the village deems as appropriate and legal, but not without some level of review and consideration. The best example of this is a special use that you recently allowed as a special use for the first time, which is a daycare center in the PRI district, right? Previously, that use was not allowed in that district. And instead of allowing it as a permitted use, you decided that it would be appropriate to allow daycares to open up in the PRI, which is basically governmental and institutional owned properties, so long as they filed an application, gave notice to the neighbors in the newspaper and on site and on the website, and came in and described their plans. You could have allowed a daycare center as a permitted use, meaning that they just come in with building plans, and then staff looks at it and says, yes, it's a permitted use, and then they could set up. But because of traffic issues, I think primarily in access issues with a daycare center, you decided that we wanted a layer of review. That's a perfect example of a special use. Others include restaurants with drive-throughs or gas stations. In your C1 commercial district, for instance, a gas station can't just open up. They have to come in and get a special use permit so that there's some layer of review by the village. The neighbors get input. There's conditions potentially imposed with regard to lighting, access, improvements, and so on before they're allowed to operate. Now, in River Forest, you don't see a high volume of special use permits, primarily because your plan development tool, it has a pretty light trigger. So we'll spend more time talking about plan developments. But if you do see special uses come through, you've at least heard about them and thought about them a little bit. Now, you'll see the standards for special use permits in the bullet points on page 4 and 5 of the handout. These bullet points come right out of your ordinance. Okay, so when your Zoning Board of Appeals hears an application for a special use, and when it comes before you as the final decision maker, the task is to determine whether or not these standards have been met. If they're all met, a vote in favor is appropriate. If one or more of them have not been met in your opinion, then a vote against is appropriate. You can see that in the standards for special uses that you really track those LaSalle and Sinclair pipeline factors that I talked about right at the outset. The idea is that when you're making decisions, we want you to be thinking that if your decision were to be challenged, the courts can see deliberation on the same things that they would look at, that you had the facts in your hands and you were looking at them. So in order for a special use to be granted, the proposed use should be consistent with the goals and policies of the comprehensive plan. Mm-hmm. The establishment of that use would not be detrimental or endanger the health, public safety, comfort, welfare of those in the village. It would not diminish the use or enjoyment of other property in the vicinity. It's consistent with the character of the village, right? These are the same things that the courts would care about, so we want you to think about them. That's why the Zoning Board makes findings on them, that if you agree, you incorporate those, telling a judge ultimately, if challenged, that, look, we did all our homework. We took in a public record under oath. We developed all these facts. As I mentioned, special use permits are under the jurisdiction of your Zoning Board of Appeals, another volunteer body with 7 appointed members. President Ducey brings forward those members for advice and consent by you. They hold public hearings, deliver a recommendation on an application, and then ultimately it's up to you to vote to approve it or not. Any questions about special uses? Okay. So we can move on to pages 6 and 7 and on, and this has to do with variations in hardship. This is a commonly discussed issue, one that's on your agenda for variations later tonight, actually. We won't be talking about those applications in particular, but we always get a lot of questions about variations and when does a hardship exist and when doesn't it exist. And we've laid out for you the state of the law, your standards, and we can have a conversation about that. So a variation is a modification to a strict requirement in your zoning ordinance. If you have a requirement that your side yard, that no structure can be built closer than 5 feet to a side lot line, and someone wants to build 3 feet from the side lot line, they need a variation. They are asking for relief from an objective standard in your code. This applies to foot distances, percentage requirements, things of that nature. Okay. And under state law, you're allowed to grant variations if strict compliance with them would present a practical difficulty or particular hardship. Those are the four words that they use in state law, which has spawned a heck of a lot of litigation, questions, and a lot of hand-wringing, right? It's difficult. As we'll talk about later, ultimately it comes down to you as a trustee applying your discretion to decide, based on this application, do I believe that there is a particular hardship or practical difficulty, or unnecessary hardship. And you should look to a history of what the village has done with such applications in the past to help inform you, along with some of the court decisions and other materials I've included here. So, yes.
Excuse me, and financial considerations are not part of a hardship, correct?
Typically, yes, that's right. And the courts will agree if you decline someone a variation for financial reasons. If their bottom line is that I just can't afford to build it in a conforming way, and you say that's not a hardship as a village board, that decision is defensible in the eyes of the court. That's correct.
Is it entitled to the same deference that a zoning ordinance would be?
Yes, it is. It is. So if you look at the bottom of page 6 onto the top of page 7, you can see what your ordinance, what your zoning ordinance says about variations and hardships. Okay, so I'm going to read this. I'm trying not to do a lot of reading from this handout, but I think this is really important language. Your code provides that a major variation shall be recommended by the ZBA only if it makes findings that each of the following standards has been met. Number one, the physical surroundings, shape, or topographical conditions of the specific property will bring a specific hardship on the owner as distinguished from an inconvenience to the strict letter of the regulation. Then we jump down to number 8, which is the next of your variation standards that speak to this. There is no means other than the requested variation by which the alleged hardship or difficulty can be avoided or remedied to a degree sufficient to permit a reasonable use of the subject property. Okay, so these are your words. This is your implementation of state law. Okay, so you'll see on the first hand, we're looking at uniqueness in the property itself, and on the second hand, we're looking at a reasonableness type standard. Okay. And the village is allowed to make for itself what hardship means. You're allowed to put color into what the state law provides. So on page 7, under legal definition of hardship, you'll see in the second paragraph there some commentary that we've developed in working with clients over the years on this issue. There's some communities, and I think River Forest, you know, takes both of these issues raised in this paragraph seriously, about preservation of natural resources like trees, let's say, and historic preservation into a hardship consideration. Okay, there's some communities where saving a tree may not be a big deal, or saving a historical structure by allowing an addition to go into a side yard instead of having someone say, "I want to take this property down or take the home down." Otherwise, you are allowed to take those things into account. In your own community, you can decide that natural preservation, historic preservation are important and make that a part of your considerations, okay? And that's really up to you as a trustee to decide in your discretion. The voters have trusted you to do a good job. Do you think that's appropriate? Not a legal question, but a policy one. In the third paragraph here under legal definition of hardship, we've seen this with some of our clients that if the zoning boards and the village boards say no to variations, you end up encouraging teardowns, right? If someone can't build the house that they want by modifying what's there,
right,
it's easier to just take it down.
Right.
And so you can think of villages in the area that where that happens. We work with some of them. The more variations you grant, the less teardowns you'll have, quite frankly. Okay. So on page 7, going on to page 8, then, we have a summary of what courts have spoken to about hardships, okay? So these are cases where a municipality has turned down a hardship in each case, and then the property owner goes to court and says, should have given it to me. That was unfair. That was arbitrary. The courts have said that hardship can't be self-created, can't be based on a need to accommodate the size of one's family or personal health issues, but that doesn't include considerations under the Americans with Disabilities Act or other federal laws that preempt your zoning authority, okay? Onto page 8, can't be based on a showing that the property would be worth more if you granted the variation. That's almost always the case, right? Someone wants to redo their kitchen and bump out into the side yard, of course, it'll be worth more. That's not a real valid argument if you turn them down on that basis. And can't be based on mere inconvenience to the petitioner if it weren't granted. So on pages 8 through 10, or sorry, 9 through 10, you'll see a table. We've actually gone out, we read all the cases on variations, and we collected and summarized them here so that if you're thinking about how do I work with this application in front of me, what do the courts say about these things? Now, these court decisions don't embody the correctness of policy decisions. These are, the courts were looking at a legal determination, for instance, in Highland Park in the Weinstein case, the first one. The city there turned down a variation for a property on a small lot with a steep backyard that really, there was no way to build within the permitted envelope, so they needed a variation to make a reasonable use of the property. The city said no. The property owner sued and said, look at my lot, it's unique. It has unique circumstances. I deserve the variation. The court said, yes, it was wrong for the city, given your lot configuration, to turn you down, okay? Similarly, if we drop down to the second set of cases where court said there was not a sufficient hardship to warrant a variation, in the Kimball-Dawson case, you had a developer in the city of Chicago who started construction without permits. And then after the fact came back to ask for a variation. It was an oops situation. There, the city made the policy decision that we wouldn't have granted this in the first place. The fact that you've put money in now and you're actually under construction and going is not legally adequate to overturn the city's policy decision to turn you down. If you look at the Cristo versus Village of Oak Park case, the second to last on page 9, Bob, this speaks back to your question. The court held that the inadequacy of family income is not a unique circumstance related to the property and does not constitute a hardship. So there, the Village of Oak Park or zoning board had turned down a property owner. Their case for hardship is that we can't afford to build a conforming structure. Give us a variation. Our hardship is our financial situation. The policy decision was made in Oak Park that did not establish a hardship, and the courts agreed with it. Okay. And so if you turn onto page 10 there and then onto page 11, we have the standards that are applied by the Zoning Board of Appeals at the public hearing phase and then by you after a recommendation is made to determine if a variation should be granted. So you'll see in these bullet points the consideration of hardship. It's in the first one and it's in the last one. Then you also get into other considerations like, did the unique physical condition result from any action of a person having an interest in the property? I suppose if someone planted an oak tree in the middle of their backyard and then later wanted a variation, you could say you created the problem if you're trying to tell us that saving that tree is really important. You'll see here on the second bullet point on page 11 that the purpose of a variation cannot be based predominantly upon a desire for economic gain. Right? That's one that you see time from time if someone is building to sell as opposed for building to own, right? They can't say, my hardship is that I'll make a lot more if you say yes. Okay? You think that that's an important enough standard to build right into your considerations. Okay? And then also the effect on the neighbors is important as well. So as I mentioned, for variations, the applications go before your Zoning Board of Appeals for a public hearing. They hear evidence under oath, accept all the information, make a vote on a recommendation, comes up to you for a final decision. In River Forest, other than appeals from the decision of the zoning administrator, the village board decides everything. Appeals from the zoning administrator's decisions go to the Zoning Board of Appeals for final determination. That's what state law says. Okay. So on to page 12, we get into plan developments.
Yes. Can I ask a question? Of course. As you know, I mean, a community like River Forest is an older community, and from time to time we change our zoning laws, which could cause some homes to come out of conformity. So what is the recommendation of, you know, how do you handle, you know, that? It's sure. You know, my home, by no fault of their own, came non-conforming.
Right, so if the village were to strictly apply the zoning regulations, it's usually in side yards or rear yards, right, where people come in, where they built to conforming and now they want to do something. If you say that we are holding our setbacks and we're not going to vary them, you're going to get more teardowns. You're going to have more people who either won't improve their properties and will sell to someone who will scrape it clean and build up. But if you do allow for people to go into the side yards within certain requirements, the housing will remain. It'll be improved and upkept more often.
Right.
That's what we've seen.
Right.
There's some communities, the Village of Hinsdale.
But it doesn't meet the hardship per se, as written, as like, it, you know, or does it? Because it's saying now your home is no longer, it's you know, no longer within the means of.
Right. Right. So I think that when you're dealing with a home which was originally built conforming and then became non-conforming because the village changed the setbacks, as a trustee, you have the discretion to read these standards and decide if you think that that constitutes an adequate hardship. I think both sides of that debate can point to things in the standards and say, well, I think I'm right, you're wrong. I think I'm right, you're wrong. So I think there's room for debate.
Yeah.
The Village of Hinsdale is notoriously stingy in giving variations. They've also experienced an incredible wave of teardowns and rebuilds. It is a partial result of that.
Yeah.
And so when balancing what, as elected officials, you think the community should look like in terms of your housing stock, I think that plays into applying these standards. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Yep.
I'm sort of on that point. So if we grant a variation to a house and say it's 3 foot setback, and we let them build 2 feet with a 2 foot setback.
Mm-hmm.
And then we later amend, and that variation runs with the land.
Yes.
We then amend the code to make it a 5 foot setback.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Would that person be precluded from building backward? So in other words, so they had a variation that allowed them to build up to 2 feet on the side with the side yard setback. Would the variation be specific to what was built, or would they maintain the ability to build on the 2 foot setback?
The zoning ordinances that you've been approving for variations for a while now have specific language that the variation is only granted to build what has been proposed in the application. So it's specific to the structure. While it runs with the land, meaning that when you go to sell it, the new owner doesn't have to worry about living in a non-conforming structure, which lenders are nervous about lending against. So we do tie the variation to specific construction. So on pages 12 through 15 of the handout, we have the material on plan developments. Pretty much any development of note in the village is done as a plan development, because development of any non-residential property over 20,000 square feet, which is a 200 by 100 foot lot or larger, or any multifamily housing, has to go through this process. Okay, so consequently, you don't get a lot of requests for special uses, because almost any property that would have a special use proposed on it, like a restaurant, you know, gas stations, daycares, they're going to be on a lot that's larger than 200 by 100, right? And the plan development tool is authorized under state law, and it gives you flexibility to hear an application and really set site-specific zoning to meet the needs of that zoning applicant if you find it's appropriate. With conditions that would make it appropriate in that location in the village. And under purpose here on page 11, I included a segment from your zoning ordinance that describes the purpose of planned developments, and I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It says here that it is recognized there are certain uses, whether designated as permitted or special, or which because of their scope or specific characteristics give a rise to a need for more comprehensive consideration with regard to neighboring land in the village in general. Such uses fall within the provision of this section shall only be permitted as authorized as a plan development.
Mm-hmm.
So you've recognized the need for flexibility on larger developments, right? You deal with a lot of institutions who've come through here and asked for who've asked for plan development approval, like the Forest Preserve District, your universities, your schools, right? Pretty much all the large landowners have to come to you so that there's a conversation. That's why development in the village is done in a very thoughtful way at that scale, because the village board has had a touch on all of that. It allows for planning to be done in an appropriate, thoughtful way. Now, the procedures here on pages 12 to 13 of the handout show just how many steps there are to get from an application to a final decision. And I note that I did not include an additional, there's extra notices that I haven't baked into these bullet points, but when someone applies for a special use permit or a variation, they send in an application, a hearing date is set, mailed notice goes out, newspaper notice goes out, hearing is held, and then it comes right to you. It's a 3 to 4 step process. You can see here that a plan development is more like an 8 to 10 step process, assuming that there's not referrals back to the development review board or other ones. There are pre-application meetings with village staff. There's a pre-application meeting with village residents. From time to time, like tonight on your regular meeting agenda, you have someone coming before you before they file for a plan development. The idea is that everyone gets input on these bigger projects in town so that the outcome is better, because more process leads to better outcome.
Hey, Greg?
Yes.
On these steps, are there timing issues or timelines?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there are. And staff has developed detailed flowcharts and explainer materials that applicants have available to them. I believe they're included on the website as well.
Yes.
And all of these are subject of various timelines.
Okay.
And also the materials are all included in the packets that get sent to the Development Review Board and to the Village Board. So for instance, the applicant is required at that neighbor meeting, as they call it, to take attendance and notes. And those minutes, notes, become a part of the record. So if people come out and want to give input, it's being built into the public record from the first instance. Okay. So after the Development Review Board holds their hearing, they apply the standards, which are the same standards that you apply. And if you look from pages 13 to 15, there's probably close to 20 standards to be applied to a plan development. I'm certainly not going to read them all, but plan developments as larger developments in town deserve the extra kind of scrutiny, like a specific look at property, the effect on property values, ingress and egress. There's on page 14, the second bullet point calls out a standard for consideration of the effect on known historical or cultural resources. Right? If someone wanted to do a plan development where a landmark or significant property was located, you'd want conversation about that. This standard gives you a link to discuss those things and to help protect those historical or cultural resources. Two down from there, we have a bullet point for the design of the proposed use or combination of uses promotes a safe and comfortable environment for pedestrians and individuals with disabilities, right? We just amended this to require the Development Review Board and the applicant to have a conversation about, if appropriate, how do pedestrians and individuals with disabilities interact with this space? Okay, so the plan development tool is meant to be flexible, and that's why you have 20 standards listed out here, because some applications won't touch on any of these. Others will touch on all of them or a portion of them. So there are so many of them so that you have the flexibility then as the Village Board to decide, is this right for our community? Another one here is whether the use is economically viable and does not pose a burden on the services, tax base, or other economic factors that it affect the financial operations of the village. From time to time, there's been applications which have hit on those points, and so the village has crafted conditions to try to address those issues. Plan developments are heard by the Development Review Board for public hearings, and then again, they come to the Village Board for a final determination after all the facts have been gathered below. Are there any questions
and
about
no,
plan developments?
There's no set requirement for how many hearings. It's based on what Development Review Board wants to, how long they want to hear it.
That's right. The Development Review Board has the discretion to decide how short or long, how many evenings to go.
Yeah. How many?
And some are, most are, depending on the application, most are usually done in one evening or two. The middle school took,
a year.
A little longer than that. Yeah.
Retiring those little guys.
Maybe two.
No,
who's counting?
All right. So,
Greg, on the plan development,
yeah.
I mean, I know we often talk about the aesthetics of the development. And is that sort of in the fitting within the surrounding properties, or could you just say, I don't like the way it looks, so I'm not going to approve it?
Right. That's a great question. The architects on the Development Review Board, when I sit with that group, ask that question a lot, and they do dive in on the aesthetics. There's a couple standards that speak to that. I think the best one is the top of page 14, that the proposed use will be consistent with the character of the village. I know it refers more to use there, but the village has traditionally been very, has had a heavy touch when it comes to aesthetics, because it has a expectation for high quality development. And so you've stacked the Development Review Board with architects to try to make sure that things look like they should, right? And so they do consider aesthetics, and I do think it's a valid consideration.
If that were the sole basis for turning it down, would that
hold up?
Be a problem?
It's trickier if it's the sole basis. I think that, you know, because aesthetics are somewhat subjective,
right.
Whereas the rest of these standards you can measure, like what's the effect on village services?
Right.
We can figure that out to a dollar. I don't think that it would be great to make it a sole basis. I would try to
couch it in other words.
Well, I would try to build,
hopefully consider other things.
Rationale, yeah. I wouldn't recommend it, let's put it that way. Because it's discretionless too. You don't have specific objective criteria to apply. All right, so when it comes next, we're gonna talk about map amendments and text amendments briefly here. So map amendments are when you change the underlying zoning on property in the village. You've not had a lot of map amendments over the years, primarily because when you grant a plan development, you don't change the underlying zoning, you leave it as is. But a property owner is allowed to come in and ask to have the zoning map changed for them if there's a reason to do so, if they're under the 20,000 square foot threshold maybe. In that case, the Zoning Board of Appeals would hear the application at a public hearing, and it would come to you for a determination. Similarly, when text amendments are proposed, which are changes to the zoning ordinance, those go before the Zoning Board of Appeals and then come to you for a final decision. The zoning ordinance is one of the very few parts of your village code that you can't just change by putting something on an agenda. Later this evening during your regular meeting, there's a proposal to amend your requirements for tobacco possession, for instance. That's not subject of a public hearing process, right? That can go on an agenda. If enough of you think it's wise, you'll pass it. When it comes to zoning, even text amendments, changes to the zoning ordinance have to be noticed in the newspaper, given public notice, held a hearing held for input, and then it comes to you for a change. So it's one of the few areas where there's a real state law process hurdle imposed before you can change it.
Yep. For the map amendments, is someone interested in buying property considered an interested person? So in other words, I'm assuming you have to be in the map, the area to be rezoned to have standing.
Tom, that's a good question. I don't recall, because I've not seen an application for a map amendment come in. If you have the that element in your code, you certainly could.
Well, that's not a matter of state law, that's local.
Correct, yes. Yeah, you can determine who has standing to apply. If you didn't allow it in your code, what we see is that developers will get a contract contingent on rezoning. The owner will apply. The developer will present as agent all of the evidence and carry it through, and if it's approved, then they'll close on the property after the rezoning's done. But with your plan development tool, that almost never happens, because any lot greater than 200 by 100 is got to come through a plan development. All right. So moving on to prohibiting uses via zoning, this is on pages 15, 16, and 17. I don't want to dwell on this too much, except to let you know that under state law, there are certain kinds of businesses that you can prohibit, okay? You do have the ability, if a good enough case can be made, that we don't want any of this in town, to not allow it. I think kind of a ridiculous example, like a livestock farm, right? No one would think that that was appropriate, not that there's any space to put one up. Yeah.
I do have town wire.
I don't get into it.
I don't know what a bagatelle is, but it was
something. We're not going to have any of them around here, darn it.
It was probably a parlor game back in the 1920s when they wrote the Illinois Municipal Code.
I got to Google that one.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's my guess.
Might be bocce. Sounds like a pasta.
So on page 16 under number 4 there, you can see that the village board can decide that any offensive or unwholesome business or establishment within the village or within 1 mile beyond your limits in unincorporated Cook County, which really doesn't apply here. There's only one small unincorporated bit over in the Forest Preserve close by, but you can prohibit offensive businesses from operating, subject to First Amendment restrictions, okay, and other federal requirements. So there's some specific issues in zoning called out here on pages 16 and 17. I'm not going to dwell on these right now, but if you have questions about the importance of traffic or what is contract zoning, what is spot zoning, those terms get thrown around sometimes, you can see some of our guidance on here. If you have questions, feel free to follow up with Eric or myself.
Mm-hmm.
Then on page 18, I have a summary here and on to 19 with the public hearing process. And I want to talk a little bit about this and why the process looks the way it does. So a public hearing typically proceeds using these steps. Now, not all of these formalities are observed every time there's a zoning hearing. But generally speaking, you have the public hearing opened up by the chairperson. They make introductory remarks and they put everyone under oath. Okay? It's important to note that when zoning hearings occur, everyone's under oath. In fact, the village board adopted an ordinance in the last year or two making it a petty offense to knowingly lie to a zoning body, because that may or may not have happened, and the village board wanted to make clear that you can't misrepresent things to try to get zoning relief, right? So once everyone's under oath, then the applicant presents its case. After the applicant presents its case, any interested person or objectors has the opportunity to ask questions of any of the witnesses and present their case. It's a quasi-court hearing. It doesn't rise to the level of a real trial, but the Illinois Supreme Court said in a decision in 2003 that zoning hearings have to follow basic due process. You have to give people an opportunity to interact with the witnesses, introduce evidence, and provide testimony within some parameters. So because the Illinois Supreme Court said that, your hearing process, as you look through this, kind of looks like a judicial process, right? We're talking about cross-examination, rebuttal witnesses, exhibits, and so forth and so on. That's because the Illinois Supreme Court said in a case involving the village of Lisle and a grocery store that went up there where it just got blown through, and the mayor said, I'm not taking any questions tonight. We're going to approve it. Let's go. The bad facts made the bad law that now your zoning hearings have to look somewhat like a courtroom setting, okay? So the idea, and when I work with your zoning board chairs, is to give everyone an opportunity to be heard within parameters. If there's a lot of people who want to speak, you can say, look, we'll give you so many minutes to speak now, and just wait, and after everyone's spoken, you're free to come back. If the line of questioning is going on for too long, please wrap it up or please bring it back in. Mm-hmm. We'll accept whatever written materials you want to submit into the record. Okay. So are there any questions about the public hearing process that's used and what the public hearings look like?
I guess my question, and that's even some of my impetus with wanting to have some of this conversation, was where trustees' role would fall during that process. So if there's questions or information that we wanted brought out to be part of the hearing, how is that ultimately best handled? You know, if we're not at my understanding is that things would come to our table to have these questions, but we've been told in previous board meetings that we're only supposed to consider what's part of the hearing. Right. So how do we as trustees get information brought out that then we can technically consider? Does that make
sure,
sense?
Sure, it does. Because so that's a great question. It highlights a tricky issue. As mm-hmm. trustees, you're held to a standard of not having ex parte communications while a zoning hearing is going on. You need to be impartial, okay? And so what the courts say is that if the zoning process if the decision makers in the zoning process, meaning you, are biased for or against a zoning application because you were having conversations outside of the hearing process and that, so influenced you, that could make the process null and void. So there's a line to be drawn between trustees participating in the process and remaining fair and impartial. And it is difficult, like in a situation you've said, that if someone isn't presenting the facts to the zoning body that you think are important to have included in the record, how do you make sure that they are a part of the record? Our advice in my office has always been that trustees should never testify at a zoning hearing if they're taking a position, because if you're stating a position to the zoning body, it seems like you're trying to steer the record in a way that could lead to you being said to be impartial.
I don't necessarily mean in terms of position, but say in my decision making, mm-hmm. there's other information that I would find helpful.
I see.
Or I had a question about something and needed further clarification, but if it wasn't provided as part of the hearing, how are we able to get that and consider it in terms of our final decision making then?
Gotcha. So on reviewing the record, you say that there's a gap in what was presented, and I wish that the applicant or an objector or staff or someone would have asked these questions so we could get answers to those. That's a great point. I'm trying to think of a appropriate way that you could express those things, and it may be to staff in that instance. If you look at an application or you're aware that there's one, because, you know, staff is not on the zoning boards. So instead of having a conversation with the, with a zoning board member, which could lead to an allegation of impartiality, you could approach staff and say, could you please ask the applicant to address these issues or try to see that some evidence on these issues is introduced into the record. I think that would keep you from getting too close to the hearing itself.
But Greg, if the hearing is closed, how do you supplement the record? Right. That, so Eric gets back with us an answer. Aren't we now considering matters that wasn't
I see.
Before the hearing?
So if the, right, I was discussing an instance where you had the ability up front to
no,
try
I'm
for
mostly,
that.
No, it's more after the fact. Because,
yes.
You know, a lot of times,
right.
If we can't attend the meeting,
it's
so
here.
We're listening to it after the fact.
Right.
So now it's been done, and questions in my mind have come
gotcha.
Up.
Gotcha.
For
then,
me to make a decision, right. How do we flesh that out?
Right.
And it, I, you know, seems like we should be able to do it at our table, but then we seem to be being told.
Right. So in that case, if there are significant material facts not included, then if the majority of you want to send it back for a further hearing, you can do that. Otherwise, you could ask the, you could, if there's part of the application that speaks to it, you could ask the applicant to try to expand on that. If there's something that's related in the record, you could say, could you please explain this issue? How does it relate to my concern? Otherwise, you always have the ability to send it back down, which adds time.
So that's what I was going to ask, Greg. So the board at that time can either deny, grant, or remand.
Remand.
Correct. That's right. Yep.
Could you go to the DRB and not offer a position one or the other, but just ask the question? So in other words, just a normal, you know.
I would suggest that that's not a good idea because it would be very difficult to police every situation where that would happen to not cause further issues. I think a better practice is to work with staff if there are specific issues we anticipate so that they can try to help make sure that your concerns are looked at least during the process.
If someone wanted to have it remanded in order to get more information, would it require more than one trustee to agree to have that happen?
Yes, that requires action of the village board, so it would be a decision of the body. Yes, that's right.
And then the next step then would be like another public hearing then, or?
Yes, that's right.
Well, would it be another public hearing, or would it, with the DRB, because we're remanding it back.
That's right, and
right.
You could say that we want
yes.
The DRB to look
yes.
At these issues. You want to tighten it up so
right.
That it's not from
right.
The ground up, and then
right.
Send it back, and they'd hold another hearing. That's
right.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then the rest of the materials, I see that we've got a
yeah.
Full room here, and I'm pretty much through it. There's some details here on voting, on conflicts of interest and Open Meetings Act. As always, if there's questions, please route them through Eric, and happy to help work with you on those items. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Just for everybody that was coming in, now this was an earlier meeting that we had at 5 o'clock regarding some of our zoning, kind of tutorial on our zoning. So we're going to take a little break then because we've got 10 minutes before our 6 o'clock. If maybe you can just, because we'd like to wait until, you know, 6 o'clock starts. That's when we said we'd start. So give us 9 minutes or 11 minutes and we'll start.